Okay, good evening, everyone. And our topic for tonight is Louis Brandeis and American Zionism. So we're going to discuss the intersection between an important figure in American history, Louis Brandeis, a Supreme Court justice, and his involvement in Jewish affairs, specifically in the matter of Zionism, where he played, at least for a little while, for about 7 years, a leading role. And that he was a surprise person to play a role in Zionism precisely because his Jewish attachments had been marginal before that. So Louis David Brandeis was born in 1856 in Kentucky. And his parents had immigrated from Bohemia, from the Prague area, after the 1848 failed revolution. They had been involved in some revolutionary activities and for political reasons had to leave the country. So they came to the United States and came to Kentucky. He was born in 1856. The family had to move out of Kentucky briefly to Indiana during the Civil War because they were abolitionists and could not be safely living in a Southern sentiment city. Also, the family moved back to Europe briefly in the early 1870s because of financial reasons. But in the end, the family came back to the United States and Louis Brandeis went to Harvard, where it is claimed that he had the highest grade point average of all time at Harvard Law School. The family did not practice Judaism. Rather, they had essentially a secularist orientation, but they believed in God, and they were a Frankist background. So who's Jacob Frank? Jacob Frank was a false messiah. In previous sessions, we've discussed his story. He's like the Shabtai Tzvi of the Ashkenazim. And in certain parts of Europe, including in Prague, there were followers of his who were basically Christian, but were of Jewish extraction and were so-called Frankist Jews. So that was Brandeis's background. His uncle, Louis Dembitz, was the only one in the family who was a regular practitioner of Judaism, was a traditional Jew, and was also a Zionist. And Louis Brandeis revered his uncle and changed his middle name from David to Dembitz. So that's why he is known as Louis Dembitz Brandeis. Okay. He went on to become a great lawyer, Louis, and he was the people's lawyer, worked out of Boston. He was a great progressive, leading the fight for the right to privacy from government intervention, rights of free speech, and he was anti-monopoly. So those were his political points of view that he tried to put forth in the court of law in his career as a great legal mind. Well, conventional historiography says that there was almost no organized Zionism in America prior to 1914 and the outbreak of World War I, and that Louis Brandeis dominated American Zionism from 1914 through 1921, and that the movement was basically moribund until 1929 or 1930, so that it basically before 1930, there's no heroic figure of American Zionism other than Louis Brandeis. Well, what's the premise? What's the real truth about the origins of American Zionism and the role that he played? In fact, the American movement was small prior to 1914, but then again, so was the world movement of Zionism small prior to 1914. Actually, America had more shekel payers, which was the coin of the realm, you know, the nominal payment that you made to the World Zionist Organization, which made you a voter for the World Zionist Congresses. So America had more shekel payers, 7,200 in 1914, than did Germany, which only had 5,000. Germany was considered the leading national branch of the Zionist movement, the best organized. And from 1907 to 1911, America ranked second or third among world shekel payers. So there were clearly people who were interested in Zionism in the United States, and yet the complaint was always that Zionism was not nearly as vibrant as it could have been, as it could have been. Why this idea that it could have been much more? Well, very simple, demographics. Large numbers of Eastern European Jews are moving to the United States every year, and there's no reason why they shouldn't have a Jewish nationalist orientation and at least be token contributors to the cause of Zionism. So it must be the failure organizationally of the leaders to rally these would-be troops to the cause of Lumiut, of Jewish nationalism. the difference between the potential for American Zionism and the actual of American Zionism would extend for basically 50 years, from 1898 when the movement was founded to 1948 when the State of Israel was established. That it always could have been more popular, and yet something sort of fell flat. There were only three stints of where Zionism was popular in America and sort of took over the popular Jewish imagination. And those eras were 1903 to 1904 during the Kishinev pogroms, 1915 to 1919 during the Brandeis era of World War I, and then again in 43 to 47 during World War II and the aftermath of the Shoah and the build up to Jewish statehood. So when did Zionism actually come to America in its first earliest form? So the answer is in the 1880s, there were Jews who were part of the Chibat Zion movement who came to the United States. And so just as Chibat Zion was this sort of fledgling weak organization in Europe, it had its representation in the United States as well. There were American Jews who were delegates to the first Zionist Congress at Basel in 1897. A handful, not too many, but there were some. And then in 1898, the Federation of American Zionists, FAZ, F-A-Z, was established. Not to be confused with F-O-Z, Friends of Zion, which is that museum in Yerushalayim. Okay, so the early leaders of FAZ were Richard Gottheil, a Reform Jew, and Jacob Dahas. So the German element were the early dominant figures in American Zionism. And Reform Jews at that, which might come as a bit of a surprise because classical Reform Judaism opposed Jewish nationalism. And while that may be true, not everybody thinks the same way. There was an alternative faction within the Reform Jewish camp that looked favorably upon the Jewish national renaissance and did not take this super duper anti-nationalist perspective, the likes of which, you know, Isaac Meir Wise or Kaufman Kohler did. So those early leaders were personally close to Herzl. They were political Zionists. But political Zionism is only one type of Zionism. What's another type?
Cultural Zionist.
Cultural Zionism, good. So cultural Zionism ended up playing a major role in the second wave of American Jewish Zionist leaders. That after 1904 and the death of Herzl, the movement was taken over by Harry Friedenwald of Baltimore, Judah Magnus of New York, and Israel Friedlander, also of New York, a professor at JTS. And they were cultural Zionists, and they were connected to the Russian Jewish masses downtown, who represented the future of American Judaism, and could potentially be, you know, the numbers, which would be the demographic force behind the movement. But even they only lasted in leadership a brief time. After 1910, the leadership was in the hands of Louis Lipsky, Bernard Rosenblatt, and Senior Abel. And those guys were thoroughly Americanized. They rose through the ranks of the American movement and were not famous. So New York Jewry was very Zionistic, but was difficult to organize. That in sentiment, a lot of Jews on the Lower East Side and elsewhere in New York had a soft spot in their heart for what the Zionists were trying to accomplish, but they weren't shekel payers, they weren't going to meetings, they weren't writing letters and signing petitions, they just in their hearts liked the idea of Zionism. But that's not good enough for a movement to be vibrant. It has to have a real serious grassroots organization. And in America, at first, the various administrations of the FAZ tried to have a centralized approach, you know, one national body with an office somewhere in Manhattan, and delegating authority to the branches out around the country. But that doesn't really work in America. It failed. The decentralized approach was much more effective, where local branches around the country get to control their own affairs, and there's some sort of figurehead group with an office in Manhattan that issues statements but doesn't really wield a lot of power. So there's always a question in American Jewish organizational life, centralized or decentralized. Decentralized seemed to work better, certainly in the case of Zionism. What were the early, the important ideological contributions of American Zionism? Well, one of them was American cultural Zionism, that overseas Zionism stressed the negation of the diaspora, the negation, shtilut ha-gola. Okay, we negate the diaspora. There's no future for the Jews in the diaspora. That is the doctrinaire approach of Ben-Gurion Zionism of Eastern Europe. Well, American Jewish leaders could not buy into that because America is the Golden Medina. And we're loath to claim that the American Galut is really a Galut at all. Or if it is, it's qualitatively different than everywhere else. That's a classic American Jewish trope, that we're different, right? Now, the events of this week might show otherwise, but American Jews like to think that America is different. So Zionism plus diaspora, Palestine plus America. That yes, you can have Zionism and you can have the diaspora. You can have Palestine and you can have America. One need not be at the expense of the other. Several important religious and cultural figures participated in this era of cultural American cultural Zionism. So one of them is Solomon Schechter. And we've spent a lot of time discussing Solomon Schechter in the religion classes. But let me just mention his relevance when it comes to Zionism. You know, the seminary, when it was reorganized in 1902, was taken over by the German Jewish element, the Auer crowd, the wealthy Reform Jews. And they took over the seminary in part because they wanted to have dignified Americanized religion for the Russian Jewish masses of the downtown who were not going to buy into Reform Judaism, but they needed something more traditional. But let's put Schechter in here to give them a cleaned up, enlightened, Americanized, westernized version of traditional Judaism. So his bosses are anti-Zionist, or at least non-Zionist, if not worse. And Schechter announced in 1905 that Zionism is a bulwark against assimilation. He almost got fired, but he didn't get fired in the end. He was able to maintain his position for the next 10 years until his death, and his overlords in the Reform anti-Zionist camp had to make peace with the fact that their leading scholar, Dr. Schechter, was a Jewish nationalist. What does it mean Zionism is a bulwark against assimilation? Well, very simply, not everybody is a pious Jew. Not everybody is keeping Chol of Yisrael and Hilchas Borer. Right, a lot of people aren't religious, and even the people who are religious are not all that religious. But we want people to not lose their Jewish identity. And Zionism, which doesn't make demands of you in the realm of theology or, for that matter, even religious practice, helps ward off the most extreme aspects of assimilation, where you cut off your ties with the community, or you marry out, whatever it is. There, we know the various manifestations of radical assimilation. If you're a Zionist, you don't fall sway to that. At least so Schechter thought. Was he right or was he wrong? The answer was he was basically right. That the American Jewish community, the civil religion of American Judaism for a long time, a healthy dose of that was the State of Israel. And before the State of Israel existed, it was support for Zionism, even among Jews who otherwise had very little, you know, to do with religious practice. So that's one point. Another was Catholic Israel. That Schechter was of the viewpoint that, you know, when we take into consideration religious questions, we look at what Catholic Israel is doing. What is Catholic Israel? It's not only the Holy Rollers, it's not only the real Pietists, but it's other people as well, people who are in their heart are good Jews. And Zionism helps maintain that connection.
Connection.
Now, what else? Achad Ha'am. Achad Ha'am was the founder or the granddaddy of spiritual Zionism, of cultural Zionism. And he had a tremendous influence over certain thinkers in the United States, including Israel Friedlander of JTS and including Mordechai Kaplan of JTS. So many of these figures are believers in a spiritual center in Palestine that will give forth sparks of light to the diaspora. But that in the diaspora, you can have good, solid Jewish communities with Judaism and Jewish national sentiment. That was the feeling among the leading figures of American cultural Zionism. Friedlander, in particular, compared the American situation to the golden era of Spain. Just as in the days of the Rambam and the Ramban, you had the golden era of Spain, you can have a golden era of American Judaism. But you're going to have it simultaneously with a newly developed, thriving Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. That was his idea. Unfortunately, he got killed at a young age, 1920, in Ukraine, in a pogrom. Okay. Louis Lipsky, who took over after the cultural Zionists disappeared or dropped their leadership roles, he stressed the political dimension, that Zionism added a healthy dose of self-respect to American Jewry. What does that mean, self-respect for American Jewry? Can anyone explain that to me?
What else?
What's self-respect? It means that Jews have a tendency in the diaspora, even in the friendly American diaspora, to want to keep their head down and not emphasize in any great way their distinctiveness. Whereas if you're a Zionist, you say, no, we're openly and avowedly Jews by national origin, Americans by citizenship, but we are proud to do something in the political realm because of our Jewish identity. It's not something we're ashamed of. So that was his perspective. The equivalent of that would be like in America after the Six-Day War, when Jews who otherwise were reluctant to show their Jewishness had a certain proud attitude about the successes of the State of Israel. That Zionism could do that for you, could lift your spirits on account of your Jewish identity. He also compared the ancient Hebrew prophets to the founders of the American Republic. It's maybe a little bit of a stretch, but okay, he did it. Another figure was Bernard Rosenblatt. We mentioned him because he ran for Congress. And he was a believer in social Zionism. But social Zionism really just means socialist Zionism. And the idea of taking progressive ideas of nationalization and cooperatives and saying they would thrive in Palestine. They may not have thrived in America, but they'll thrive in Palestine. By 1914, the Federation of American Zionists had achieved organizational stability and some good intellectual content, but lacked a major leader who was famous. Now, all these people are Jewish famous. Like Elon Gold used to say, there's a difference between famous and Jewish famous. So these were not big, renowned people in the wider American world. And it would take the arrival of Louis Brandeis to change all that. Now, Louis Brandeis' conversion to Zionism was never properly explained in his lifetime. And it's possible that even he did not fully understand it. And we're going to get into theories tonight in a few minutes, maybe in 20 minutes from now, as to speculating why he developed an affinity for Zionism later in his life. He was already in his 50s at that point. He was leaning towards Zionism in the years prior to 1914, but then made a bold decision in August of 1914 to accept the chairmanship of the Provisional Zionist Executive Committee. Jacob de Haas convinced him to take the job, arguing that world Jewry was going to depend upon American Jewish leadership, and that the guys like Jacob Schiff, the rich daddy, the Red Daddy Warbucks, who was a non-Zionist and was an elitist, could not rouse the masses to do what was needed to be done on behalf of our brethren across the ocean in Europe.
They needed a woman.
You needed a woman? Well, that's where Henrietta Zold comes in.
You're right.
Well, she played an important role with Hadassah and was able to accomplish things that nobody else could among the elite. Right. The movement needed a guy like Brandeis. Brandeis was a sober jurist, but when it came to Zionism, he was basically a romantic. Things didn't always make sense. They weren't always logical and coherent. He was a romantic. He made his one and only visit to Palestine in 1919. Brandeis did not issue a formal statement of ideology. Never did. But rather, he peddled a handful of phrases and statements that in speeches that he gave around the country between 1914 and 1916. And three things stand out among the ideas that he expressed. One, America made the coexistence of different national cultures not only possible, but legitimate. That different national cultures can exist within the United States. It's not only possible, but it's legitimate. Now, let me pause for a second to explain the various theories that existed over time about what America should be. The early theory was that there was WASP cultural conformity, that the WASP, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, invented America, and everybody else who arrives afterward has to conform to the cultural norms established by the WASP leadership. That was, you know, the conventional thinking for a long, long time. But at some point along the way, in the early 20th century, the idea developed of the melting pot, that we're not going to stay with one culture forever, a WASP culture, but rather the various different groups that arrive on these shores will all contribute something to, you know, to flavor the broth that is the soup, which is America. And in the melting pot, something emerges, a unified culture, which has bits and pieces of everybody else's subculture that they brought with them from overseas. But beyond that, the third level in the development of the theory behind American culture was cultural pluralism. The man who most is associated with this idea is Horace Kallen. Horace Kallen's father was an Orthodox rabbi. He went to Harvard and became a big sociologist and was the leading figure at Harvard for years and years and years on cultural pluralism. We could spend a whole session on him, but I don't think you guys would find it all that interesting, so we're not going to. I'll just mention him in passing here, Horace Kallen. And the idea of cultural pluralism was that it's not an illegitimate thing for people who have cultural baggage that they brought with them on the boat from abroad to sustain it, and to sustain it in something of a pristine form, so long as it doesn't conflict with the basic values of good American citizenship. And nobody wants to admit that their culture conflicts with American citizenship, so everybody's going to say, well, we can be this and we can be that. I can be a pious Jew, or I can be a Jewish nationalist and be a good citizen of the United States and vote in elections and hold my higher office and so on and so forth. So Brandeis takes as one of his most important pieces the idea that you can be a great, in America, you can have this cultural coexistence and nobody's at fault. Secondly, he said, there's an identity of ideals between Americanism and Zionism. Therefore, being a good Zionist also makes you a good American, that there is no conflict between one and the other. If there were a conflict, we'd have a problem. But he says there isn't any. It's easy to say that in 1914, 15, and 16, because after all, what American interests are there in Palestine, in the Middle East, that might conflict with Jewish concerns? Maybe none. At a later time, you know, oil interests and the State Department and the Arabists and the anti-Semites, we know over the last 75, 80 years that there can be a clash between so-called Jewish national interests and perceived or claimed American interests, ad hayom hazeh, until our very day. But in 1914, that was a non-factor, so Brandeis could get away with saying this sort of thing. The third thing is that it's a matter of personal honor and noblesse oblige for modern American Jews to be involved in Zionism. In other words, it's a chesed, it's a tzedakah that we're going to do for the persecuted Jews of elsewhere, that we're going to engage in this kind of political activity, and it's the right thing to do, noblesse oblige. Of course, what the unstated thing, but which sometimes was also stated explicitly, was that Zionism is something we do as a chesed, as a tzedakah, for other people. We don't do it for us because we don't need it. And why don't we need it? Because America is different. America is different. And we're not going to have any tzaris. We're not going to have any troubles, the likes of which our brethren abroad experience. Okay. So most of Brandeis's material was not new. It had been articulated by prior leaders. The major difference in the Brandeis era was that of focus, that previously the focus of the Zionist movement in America was on the internal polemics within the Reform movement about the legitimacy of Jewish national identity. In other words, the Zionist leaders had to go to the Reform rabbis and say, hey guys, I know you have a Pittsburgh platform and you want to denationalize Judaism, but you know, consider this idea as kosher as well, and maybe you'll want to support our endeavors. So it was always focused on getting the rabbis, the heterodox rabbis, and the Jews themselves to buy into this notion. Under Brandeis, the focus shifted to an outward direction. Now it was trying to justify Zionism, not to an internal Jewish constituency, but rather to the broader American public, and to do so in distinctly American terms, not in Jewish terms. Okay. Let me quote to you from a speech that Brandeis gave to a CCAR convention, the Reformed Rabbis East Coast Convention in 1915. He said the following. The Zionists seek to establish this home in Palestine because they are convinced that the undying longing of Jews for Palestine is a fact of deepest significance, that is a manifestation in the struggle for existence by an ancient people which has established its right to live, a people whose 3,000 years of civilization has produced a faith, culture, and individuality which enables it to contribute largely in the future, as it has in the past, to the advance of civilization, and that it is not only a right merely but a duty of the Jewish nationality to survive and develop. They believe that only in Palestine can Jewish life be fully protected from the forces of disintegration, that there alone can the Jewish spirit reach its full natural development, that by securing for those Jews who wish to settle there the opportunity to do so, not only those Jews, but all other Jews will be benefited, and that the long perplexing Jewish problem will at last find a solution. So what he's telling these Reform rabbis is that you're wrong to strip away the national component of Jewish identity, that it is of great significance. It's been around for 3,000 years. You can't just throw it in the garbage. And that we've had a glorious past, and we could have a glorious future. And that glorious future could happen, at least for some of our brethren, in Palestine. And that only in Palestine can there be the fullest flowering of our indigenous culture and civilization. So these are sorts of things that the Reform rabbis might not want to hear, but he's saying, and he believes it with sincerity. Then, let no American imagine that Zionism is inconsistent with patriotism. So, of course, if he says, let no American imagine it, it's because, in fact, many Americans were imagining it. They could not fathom how belief in the resurrection of a Jewish national state could be consistent with good citizenship in America. Multiple loyalties are objectionable only if they are inconsistent. That's a classic line. Multiple loyalties are objectionable only if they are inconsistent. And so long as you can show that they are not inconsistent, then there's no reason to object at all. A man is a better citizen of the United States for being also a loyal citizen of his state and of his city and for being loyal to his college. So he's saying, I'm a loyal American, but I could also be a loyal person, a resident of the state of New York, a loyal citizen, the resident of the town of New Rochelle. So therefore, just as I have multiple loyalties based upon jurisdiction, so too a Jew can have a loyalty to the Jewish homeland. Eli's asking, did they have any contact with Herzl? So Herzl was dead already 10 years. Herzl died in 1904. The earlier figures did have contact with Herzl. Okay. So every American Jew who aids in advancing the Jewish settlement in Palestine, though he feels that neither he nor his descendants will ever live there, will likewise be a better man and better American for doing so. Therefore, there is no inconsistency between loyalty to America and loyalty to Jewry. So Brandeis is saying that I don't think I'm going to move there. I don't think my children will ever move there. My grandchildren will ever move there. Never. We're here, at Sof Kaladoros until the end of time. But doing this good political work makes me a better American. So was his idea. In 1918, during the tail end of the war, there was a Pittsburgh program which was drafted. The Pittsburgh program was not the Pittsburgh platform of 1885 of the Reform rabbis. This is the Pittsburgh program was a statement of purpose upon the founding of the Zionist Organization of America, that the old Federation of American Zionists gave way to a new centralized bureaucracy, the ZOA, which still exists until our own times. And this statement had a very left-wing flavor to it. It called for the ownership and control of the land by the whole people, all natural resources, and all public utilities. All land owned and controlled by the people shall be leased on conditions that will ensure the fullest possibilities for development and continuity of possession. The cooperative principle should be applied as far as possible in free education for all children. In other words, just like you have JNF and Karen Ayesod buy property, buy assets to be controlled by the Jewish people forever and only leased to private leaseholders for 99 years or for 49 years. So the idea was that you don't give up on the whole nation controlling the Jewish resources of Eretz Israel. A very important concept that is consistent with socialist Zionism, but was articulated by Americans during the war. Now, one of the major accomplishments of Brandeis was in building up the place of American Zionism within the world movement. 1914 was a propitious time for American Zionism. American Jews, more so than any other Americans, were concerned about the Great War and the fate of their brethren back home. You know, America didn't enter the war until early 1917. The war had been dragging on for almost 3 years at that point. Americans were aloof to the whole thing for the most part. Just like in World War II, most Americans were indifferent to the matter from September 1st, 1939 until Pearl Harbor. It was a European war. Let them fight it out over there. So Jews, because we have our brethren across the ocean in the Alter Heim, Jews were concerned about what's going on, what's happening to my mother, my father, my brother, my sister back home. And that led to a lot of Zionist to a Zionistic turn, because what is the solution to the Jewish problem? Eretz Yisrael, potentially. So it was a time of the Joint Distribution Committee, the American Jewish Congress, general American Jewish agitation for the fate of world Jewry. So the Provisional Zionist Emergency Council quickly came to be at the forefront of American Jewish communal life. And Brandeis would take over the Provisional Zionist Emergency Council. What happened was that the Zionist executive was located in Berlin. But during a world war, can you have an international movement with its headquarters in the capital of one of the warring parties? It's not a good idea, because it means you're cutting off half your audience. So Zionism had to move to a neutral country. And they did, to Sweden. They officially moved to America, to New York. But the Americans never fully controlled the movement, but they still played an important role, because America was neutral for so long. And Brandeis, as the leader of the American faction, came to assume this great weighty position in the broader movement. Who helped Brandeis? You know, Brandeis could not work alone. He had to have collaborators. So it was the Brandeis group. And these were thoroughly Americanized Jews, who included Julian Mack, Felix Frankfurter, the later Supreme Court Justice, Robert Zold, Bernard Flexner, Stephen Wise, the rabbi, and Jacob Dahas. Beyond that, there was an outer circle that had Horace Kallen, Benjamin Cohen, Alexander Sachs, big, big names. Most of these, the inner group, were highly educated. Many were lawyers. Many came from Harvard. So this was an elitist Harvard kind of group. It was largely non-democratic in the sense that the Russian Jewish masses did not have much of a say over the affairs of the Zionist movement. Brandeis and his henchmen did whatever they wanted to do. This could not last forever, because America is a democratic country, and we want our political movements and organizations to be responsive to the wishes of the people. So it was inevitably going to be the case that the Hamon Am, the masses, were going to rise up and depose Brandeis, because he was alienating a lot of different factions. But they tolerated him in a position of authority, because who wouldn't want a Supreme Court justice to be your leader of your group? Okay, well, one of the important things that Brandeis did was to convince President Wilson to support the Balfour Declaration. What happened there? The Balfour Declaration is erroneously regarded by many people as having been the work of just Britain, but that's not true. The Balfour Declaration was really the consensus of the world powers. It just happened to be the case that Britain issued it under Lord Balfour, the government of Lloyd George, because they felt it was in their interest and they were going to occupy Palestine. So they issued the declaration, but it was agreed upon by many of the world powers, including the United States. Brandeis, in private conversation with Wilson in October of 1917, a month before the declaration was issued, was able to secure the support of the American president for the gist of this declaration. And it was consistent with Wilson's perspective of self-determination in the 14 points, that Jews are also going to get self-determination in their ancient historic homeland. Wilson did not publicly articulate his support for Balfour until the summer of 1918, for a variety of political reasons we're not going to get into now. Okay. Eventually, the Brandeis group lost their hold over American Zionism in 1921. And why did this happen? Well, number one, There was a rapid decline in affiliation with the Zionist movement and shekel payers in 1920. Why did this happen? In part, disgruntlement over his leadership, but also because American Jews rally during a crisis. When the crisis is over, what do? They go play golf, or they go to the ball game, all right? When something is really urgent, we'll go to Madison Square Garden, not for a Knicks game or a Rangers game, but for a rally for 25,000 Jews to protest, you know, for the right cause. But when the rally is over and the cause has come to a conclusion, then we're not so interested in paying shekel dues anymore and being involved in organizational life. So there was a dramatic drop off in the early 1920s in shekel payers, and in the 1920s was a dead time for American Zionism. The other thing is, the local organizations wanted to regain their control and basically deposed a centralized bureaucracy based out of New York. The major fight between Brandeis and the leaders of World Zionism, and for that matter, the Russian Jews in New York, was over the matter of Gegenwart Arbeit. What does Gegenwart Arbeit mean? It's a German word. What does it mean? Gegenwart Arbeit. It means work in the present. Arbeit, work. Gegenwart, present. So what does work in the present mean? Anybody know? Anybody know? Nobody? Nobody paid attention last year? Okay. So it means that Zionism is trying to build up Eretz Yisrael, and that's something for the future. You know, decades from now, a generation or two from now, there'll be a Jewish state one day with a Jewish majority in Eretz Yisrael. Wonderful, but not now. What do we do now? That's the question. So those like Brandeis were believers in political Zionism only, and for that matter, practical Zionism. And practical Zionism meant building up Eretz Yisrael, the physical presence of Jews in Eretz Yisrael. So you spend your money on a shed, a goat, a horse, on the kibbutz in Eretz Yisrael. That's what you spend your money on, although he didn't like kibbutzim because he didn't like cooperatives necessarily. So the money should be spent on real world material issues of concern in Palestine. What others wanted was Jewish nationalism in the diaspora, cultural Zionism wherever Jews may be, which means education, spending money on teaching Hebrew, on teaching even Torah, traditional Jewish subjects, keeping Jews Jewish in the Chutz La'aretz. Brandeis, as an irreligious Jew, who only is coming to this as a matter of philanthropy to build up a presence in Palestine, doesn't know from this stuff. So Achad Ha'am is not his cup of tea. He just wants to build up Eretz Yisrael. Well, the Russian Jews in America, the American Jewish Congress, were tied to the Paul A. Zion movement. And Brandeis thought that America was different. The Pole Zion people, they said, no, America is not different. Everywhere in the world, Jews need to rally, preserve their Jewish identity, their nationalist orientation, and eventually make their way to Eretz Yisrael. Brandeis said, no, America is different. You'll do your thing over there, and you'll go to Israel, and I'll pay for it, and I'll build up the country, but I'm not going to pay for you to teach Hebrew to your kid in Poland, or for that matter, teach Hebrew to your kid in New York. That's not what I'm interested in. The divide really was exposed at the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, and Menachem Ussishkin insisted that Jews the world over are one people, Am Echad, not just in some abstract sense, but legally, that in terms of gaining political rights, the Jews are a national group, transnational national group. Brandeis said that's dangerous. That's not true. American Jews are American citizens, and everybody else is everybody else. So don't lump us together with your idea of Am Echad, of one nation. We agree to that only in theory, in the abstract, but not in the real sense. Brandeis and Weizmann were at loggerheads over whether to include Jewish organizations in the nascent Jewish agency. Brandeis said, no, we're just building up Palestine. And Weizmann said, yes, we're cultivating Jewish identity the world over. So this was a battle that Brandeis lost. And in the end, Louis Lipsky took over the movement and Brandeis disappeared from the scene. He had alienated pretty much every group within the Jewish community. He had alienated the socialists. He had alienated the Orthodox. He had alienated the old blind German R crowd. He was a big name, and he was in charge for 6-7 years, but he lost out, and American Zionism didn't move in that direction. He was a philanthropist the rest of his life, supporting pet causes in Eretz Israel.
But Rabbi,
yeah.
I want to ask a question. The fact that World War I was such an anomaly, because we had Jew fighting Jew.
Yes, that's true.
Speak right after that fact about we're one people, it's not exactly palatable because of the divisions between, you know, an Austrian Jew, a Russian Jew.
So that was the great challenge that the Zionist movement as a bureaucracy had. How do you maintain a cohesiveness when people live in different countries and are citizens of countries that are at war with each other? It's not so simple. You could be accused of disloyalty or insufficient patriotism or espionage or treason for collaborating on Jewish affairs with somebody from a country we're at war with. It was a real big challenge.
It was a very tough time to form an organization after World War One because of this. And the canard of dual loyalty, you know?
So let's get to the issue of dual loyalty. So one of the things that the Brandeis' association with Zionism was supposed to accomplish was to forever remove the notion that dual loyalty was a Jewish sin in the United States. After all, if a Supreme Court justice, the ultimate American, could have this affiliation, this political attachment, it must be that it's kosher and you can't criticize anybody for it. Well, that was supposed to be the case, but it wasn't actually the case. Because in the 20s and 30s, plenty of Gentiles, and including some Jews, also said that Zionism was a manifestation of an illegitimate dual loyalty. And certainly with the establishment of the State of Israel, anti-Semites would harp on this point consistently over the years. Okay, now we get to the fun question of the night. Why did Brandeis choose Zionism, considering his prior non-involvement in Jewish affairs? So one theory is that he chose Zionism in order to advance in American politics. Let me explain what that means. He had to prove his Jewish bona fides. This theory is based on the fact that he turned to Zionism shortly after having been turned down for a position in the Wilson cabinet early in the administration. Wilson was eager to appoint a Jew to a cabinet post, but that Jew had to be acceptable to the leading machers like Jacob Schiff. And so it had to be a representative Jew. If Wilson was going to appoint a Jew, it had to be a representative Jew, not someone who was accidentally or incidentally Jewish, but otherwise had nothing to do with the community. And since Brandeis had nothing to do with the community and he didn't get a job, if he wanted to get an appointment, what did he have to do? Re-engage with his Jewish people. That's a theory. Others reject this theory, that the idea that Brandeis was so unprincipled. Because after all, Brandeis was a very principled man. He even voted down New Deal legislation if he thought it violated the Constitution. But rather, they say that Brandeis had a change of heart over time, that he came from an assimilated family, but it was a prominent family, noticeably Jewish. And Brandeis had nothing negative to say about Zionism in an interview in 1910. And slowly but surely, he came to realize its importance. Brandeis had supported the progressive candidate La Follette in 1912, but that candidacy failed. He then supported Wilson starting in the summer of 1912 and was under consideration to be Attorney General or Secretary of Commerce. On March 1st, 1913, 3 days before Wilson was inaugurated as president, Brandeis was turned down for a cabinet post. On March 20th, Brandeis already was participating in a welcome for Nachum Sokolow, a leading Zionist, and the ball was rolling for him to join the movement. On January 28, 1916, he was appointed to the court. Businessmen opposed Brandeis's cabinet appointment, including Jewish businessmen. But by 1916, the Jewish businessmen no longer opposed. In other words, what happened was Brandeis was a radical lawyer, and the Chamber of Commerce crowd, the conservatives, the Republicans and conservative Democrats, didn't like him, including Jews who didn't like him. And they did not want him in the cabinet. So he was eventually rejected, despite Wilson seriously considering him and regarding him as a trusted advisor. But by 1916, Jews didn't oppose his court nomination. Why? Arguably because he had made himself more Jewish. Eres Giyidish, he Jewified himself. Well, Brandeis first met Wilson in August of 1912. He quickly became a close advisor. Progressives wanted the people's lawyer to be the attorney general, but there was pressure from the conservative groups to prevent this. They regarded him as a harebrained radical bent on destroying American prosperity. Sounds like something people would say today. A harebrained radical bent on destroying American prosperity. You'll hear that in the news tonight somewhere. Brandeis lacked backing among Democrats, and he was the best hated man in America. Progressives like William Jennings Bryan and La Follette supported Brandeis for a cabinet post, but their support was insufficient. Schiff wanted a real Jew, not a bogus Jew, and Brandeis didn't qualify. Schiff considered Brandeis a representative American, but not a representative Jew. So there's no documentary evidence that any concerted campaign was waged by leading Jews against Brandeis, but we know they weren't his biggest fans. So arguably, Brandeis was appointed to the court in 1916 as part of Wilson's reelection campaign in a year when he turned politically to the left. And Brandeis was appointed because he was pro-labor and not because he was a Jew. So this is an important point. Everyone tended to think, Wilson appointed Brandeis because he wanted to appoint a Jew. Well, lav dafka, not necessarily. It could have been purely for political reasons, not for ethno-religious political considerations.
Then ironically, it became the Jewish seat.
Correct. It became the Jewish seat, and it was held all the way down until there was more than one Jewish seat. Now there are three Jewish seats. Okay. So the claim that Brandeis turned to Zionism in order to advance his prospects of getting a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States is basically bogus. Becoming a Zionist or getting the endorsement of Jacob Schiff did not sway the votes of even one senator for the confirmation process. Also, if he wanted grassroots Jewish support, then there were better ways to get that than becoming a Zionist. After all, Zionism was a marginal group within American Jewish life. What he really should have done if he wanted to get the backing of the important Jews was get on the non-Zionist American Jewish Committee. That would have for sure been a much safer political play if he wanted to get his co-religionist or kinsman's support. But the truth of the matter is that the American Jewish Committee didn't want to touch Brandeis with a 10-foot pole. Because why? They're stodgy old conservatives, and they didn't like Brandeis's radicalism. Louis Marshall consistently opposed Brandeis's nomination for federal office. Why? He was a Republican. And Marshall rejected the notion that there is such a thing as a Jewish vote. He said Jews should vote like their fellow citizens. Some vote for Democrats and some vote for Republicans, but based upon your analysis of the issues, not because there are Jewish concerns in particular. So our crowd did not like Brandeis. It would have been wise for him to try to pursue their support if he wanted to get on the court, but he didn't, and he wasn't going to get it anyway. And so that wasn't the reason why he went towards Zionism.
Why didn't he pursue the laborites, people who were in labor?
Okay, so he was their biggest champion, but they did not necessarily have the kind of clout that was needed to get somebody on the court until they did, until 1916. Okay, so if it's not true that Brandeis so-called converted to Zionism for opportunistic reasons, then why did this idea gain so much traction? It's a classic question that I often ask. In other words, if it isn't true, why did people say it? That's a very important question, historical question you could ask about a lot of things. If it isn't true, why did people say it? So the answer is actually well known. Not well known, but is known, is provable. William Howard Taft, our 27th president who got stuck in the bathtub. So he accused Brandeis of becoming a super Jew to gain Jewish support for his nomination. In other words, all that we've mentioned until now, it wasn't really true, but William Howard Taft claimed that it was. And his assertions ended up being spread far and wide and took on the veneer of being truthful or correct. So he accused Brandeis of being dishonest and said that the Jews were right to not want Brandeis as their first kinsman on the court. So here Taft was saying, I'm not an anti-Semite. I don't oppose Jews on the court. And in fact, I'm saying the Jews themselves shouldn't want this guy as their first Jew in the court. They should want somebody else because he's a scoundrel. So said Taft about Brandeis. What was in it for Taft? What was in it for Taft? Who knows? What did Taft do eventually? He joined the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah.
Taft was appointed by Warren Harding. Well, Taft wanted to be appointed by Woodrow Wilson. The reason it didn't happen was because Taft was a conservative and Wilson wasn't going to appoint a conservative to the court. Now, it's not like today where everything is very partisan, you know, and the Democrats appoint liberals, and the Republicans appoint conservatives. There was a little bit more of a crossover back then, but it was exceedingly unlikely that Wilson was going to appoint Taft. Nonetheless, when the seat was available in 1916, Taft was angling for it and besmirching Brandeis as being a, you know, a bad guy. Okay, so what else did Taft say? He accused Brandeis of, well, there's a lot of bad blood between them. And Brandeis had been an adversary of the Taft administration. Much of Taft's accomplishments had been threatened by lawsuits filed by Brandeis in the court. So in 1916, Taft wrote of Brandeis having been metaphorically recircumcised. How do you like that? Metaphorically recircumcised. Here he was a Jew who was like Nishtayid. He was a Goyish Jew. And now all of a sudden he's like a super duper Jew. He's metaphorically recircumcised. And they put a yarmulke on him. And he went to the long bearded rabbis to advance his political career. So there's a letter that Taft wrote to a colleague of his with all this real nasty rhetoric and curious descriptions that they put a yarmulke on Brandeis' head and he went to the long-bearded rabbis for their support. Okay, well, Taft called Brandeis a socialist and noted that most of the leading Jews in America don't tend towards socialism. Very fascinating. Taft, the Republican, said most Jews are not socialists. Now, the Jews that he knew were not socialists. The wealthy ones who tended toward political conservatism, those were his friends or associates. The downtown socialist crowd was kind of foreign to William Howard Taft. So he said, no, most Jews don't tend toward socialism. So in fact, the Jews themselves shouldn't want Brandeis on the court. Taft wrote to Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who was in charge of the committee, that the Jews don't oppose Brandeis, even though they should, and that Brandeis was made a president of a Jewish organization to in turn make it impossible for the Jews to oppose his candidacy. So basically what Taft was claiming was, once Brandeis was the president of a Zionist group, there was no way the Jews were going to oppose his candidacy. So he became the president, not because he had sincere convictions, but because he wanted to be able to get to guarantee Jewish support. So he's accusing Brandeis of being a Zionist in bad faith. The dean of the law school at Boston University said that Taft is distinguished in his jurisprudence and Brandeis is distinguished in his Jewish prudence. Nice little play on words. Okay. So Brandeis ultimately came to his Zionism by way of his Americanism. In order to be a good American, you got to be a better Jew. To be a better Jew, you got to be a good Zionist. But he was not pushed into Zionism by domestic political considerations. Rather, he was pulled into it by forces of world events. That unlike Schiff and Simon Wolfe, who looked at American Ostjuden, Russian Jews, with disdain, Brandeis learned to love the Ostjuden in America, the Russian Jews in America. He wanted to Americanize them, and Zionism was a mechanism by which he could do so. So he was thrust into a position on the world stage, and he identified with the little guy against big corporations, and thus he identified with beleaguered world Jewry against powerful political forces. So it made sense for Brandeis to end up as a Jewish nationalist in that in America, you know, he sees sinister forces of the large corporations, of big powerful entities suppressing the rights and potential success of the downtrodden. And the same thing on the world stage. The Jews have been the downtrodden for too long, and it's time to elevate them, to raise them up. And you can do that only by building up Eretz Yisrael, and you can only build up Eretz Yisrael if there's a political movement the world over to make that possible. There's also one other consideration, and that is Brandeis wanted a political appointment in 1913, and he didn't get one. What happens for public intellectuals and public figures who want a job in government, a prestigious job in government, and who are not given that job? And then there seems to be no prospect for such a job for the next 4 years. What do those people end up doing?
They join a think tank.
They go into the nonprofit world or to a think tank. In other words, they have to keep themselves busy with something. Granted, he was a lawyer and he made Parnassa, but in the public sphere, he wanted to be busy with something. And Zionism offered him that opportunity to take on an important role, the likes of which he didn't get in government, but which he would get a few years later with the court appointment. Okay, now Brandeis would maintain his seat on the court until 1939, when he would retire at the age of 83, and then he died in 1941 at the age of 84. He gave various interviews in 1940 after his retirement to discuss, you know, what his life had been like, his career, and he was in many ways an elder statesman for the Jewish community, but a person who, other than the fleeting moments of 1914 to 1921, was not really involved in the Jewish community. His involvement in Eretz Yisrael was limited to a little bit of philanthropy after he was no longer the formal president of the organization. Now, one last point before I take a couple of questions is that American Zionism would then go on to have an era of irrelevance until such time as 1929, after the Hebron riots, when you have the Jewish Agency become essentially the governing institution of the Jewish community of Eretz Yisrael. Then American Jews take a part in the expanded Jewish Agency, which included diaspora figures that held voting positions on the expanded roster. This was a chidush, a novelty of Weizmann's. He wanted to expand the base of participation, largely for the money reasons. The American Jews have the money, and if you don't give them a vote, a say, they're less likely to cough up the dough, to give you the cash. So American Jews participated in the Jewish Agency executive from 1929 all the way to the establishment of the State of Israel. So American Zionism plays a top, although it has a lot of dead time where not much is happening. So it's important to recognize that even when sentiment favors the building up of Eretz Yisrael, it doesn't mean there was an active movement that was powerful and strong throughout those years. Any questions? Questions?
Question.
Yeah.
Question. You know, it's interesting. I'm surprised that he was able to get into Harvard, and other people were getting into Harvard, and they were Jews.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm just shocked that, because in the 50s, it wasn't so easy to get into Harvard if you were a Jew, but then it was.
I wouldn't say that it was easy. I would say that the number was probably quite small, but the people who were there went on to have illustrious careers. So the fact that we remember that there was this person or that person or that person went to Harvard, it doesn't mean that they were one of many. It means they were one of a few, but those few were great intellectuals.
Uh-huh. Okay, any news about his family, his progeny?
I don't know much about them. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that other than himself, there was much involvement in Jewish affairs.
And Felix Frankfurter, was he more involved Jewishly?
Yes. Yes.
He was.
He was involved in Zionism as part of the Brandeis group, but he was more connected to the Jewish community than Brandeis had been. Absolutely.
Is he German? Is he German, Felix?
Frankfurter, of course, Frankfurter.
But I think in general, the quality, I mean, Gordas wrote a book about the State of Israel.
Yeah.
And he says there was a big difference between people who came from Europe, the thinkers, all the different diversity of political, of Zionism, than you had in America. America was much more, well, they weren't driven. They weren't harassed like the Jews in Europe. So the passion of Eastern European Jewry and the differences between their thoughts and their tactics were much more texturized than what you have in America.
There was less urgency in America for a person to come up with a solution to the Jewish problem. So because there wasn't that urgency, you find that your average rank and file Jew is not focused on solutions to world Jewish problems, but rather just getting ahead, their material existence, and maybe their spiritual and religious existence, but they're not obsessing over what will be, because we know what will be. We're staying here in America.
So it's at the times like Kishinev or these individual crises.
Yeah.
They, you know. Right.
So, I mean, the reason why early on, whenever there was a crisis in Russia, American Jews woke up very quickly to things is because attachments, there were still direct family members, immediate family members across the ocean. As time moves on and there's less of a connection, then there's less of a sense of urgency. In other words, how many Jews in America were up in arms in the late 30s trying to rescue Jews out of Europe, out of continental Europe? Some, but not all that many by percentage-wise. And why is that the case? Because immigration had largely stopped after the enactment of restrictive immigration laws in 1921-24. So yeah, you had cousins overseas and maybe you cared about them, but it wasn't like your brother, your mother, your father had to be rescued. For those who came a little later, that was the case. But for those who had arrived in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, it's a long time ago. The connection is more tenuous. So that's why earlier on, Zionism is seen as a good solution to our crisis, because our people are directly involved. Okay, we'll stop here. Next week, we'll discuss Jewish participation in World War I. All right, guys, take care.
Bye.